Well, welcome to the first session of our week together and that's okay. And Holden Village. How is everybody today? How was sleeping last night?
Lovely. How was your sleep?
Anybody have any trouble sleeping?
Yes.
Okay, anybody without kids?
Yes.
Until the sprinkler came on.
Did you know about the sprinkler?
No. I got up to try to figure out what the noise was. And it was hitting the tree. It was like...
Yes. Yeah. Every morning, the sprinkler... If you're down here, you might not have heard it. I don't know if it's all around the village, but I've never actually seen the sprinkler. But I believe, I have faith they exist.
They do.
I've turned them on.
Oh, you turned them on. Okay, so for real. Plenty of room. If you're not familiar, there are sprinklers. They call them water birds. Is that right?
Rain birds.
And they come on every morning at 6:30?
About 6:15.
Every other day.
6:15.
Every other day.
All right, maybe I should have you explain. Every other day. But they are... a fire prevention method since the big fire back 6-7 years ago. And they keep the buildings and everything moist enough that... So, you know, if you're an early riser, they're a good alarm clock. If you're not, you'll have some good sleep right after. But I always find my best sleep is between when I wake up and I don't want to get up and then 2 hours later or whatever when I'm actually needing to get up. That's the best sleep and the worst to interrupt. So. Well, my name is Kathy Pino. I am here as part of the Glocal Musicians, but this week, which is usually my role, this week I get to be here also doing some facilitating of conversation. So today and through Friday, this time slot, we will be talking about the Bible and Empire, which is a very broad category, or a very broad title, and we have an hour each day. So we will probably zip through some things, and I hope have some conversations about how those things, the ancient things we talk about, how we see them in our own lives, or apply them in our own lives, or... How we receive that information, and screensaver. I should have reset that.
It was very soothing.
Yeah, well, that's true. I can leave it on there for a minute when it comes up because I am not very conversant, as you can see. How do you make it your whole screen?
Present.
Just find a young person.
Or just leave it.
Slideshow.
Slideshow, right? Yep.
From the beginning.
From the beginning.
Whoa.
Yay! Oh, look at that.
From the beginning in a Bible study.
In the beginning. Now it's even bigger. So. Just a quick introduction. As my local teammates can attest, many of them have known me through my seminary journey of about 10 years, working on a couple different master's degrees. One was in racial justice, and then I found out you can tack on a second, it's that easy. You can tack on a second one using many of the credits from your first one if you do it within a short amount of time. So I did a second master's in biblical studies, and that's really where my passion is right at that intersection of justice and the Bible, and how do we talk about justice, those of us for whom the Bible is a reality in our lives, a sacred book, a not sacred book that we recognize has influence. I recognize that not everybody in here may have biblical traditions at all. Some of you may have strong biblical traditions. So as we're talking, feel free to raise your hand, clarify. If something doesn't sit right with you, bring that up, and we'll figure that out. So, what is the Bible? We'll start with the easy question. Well, let me back up first. Now I see why they were both on the same side. This was my hope for today. I think we can do this in an hour. A broad overview of Christianity's sacred text through the lens of history. What was the impact of empire on the theology, cosmology, and worldview of the communities from whom we receive our scriptures? Easy peasy. Now how do I go back? Oh, I see. Oh my gosh, such a learning. Sorry, you're my learning curve. And we may or might not do these things in this order, but this is sort of where things will go. We will also talk about just the kings and how the books of the kings describe for us a history, one of the histories or renderings of the history of how things went from Israel as somewhat its own nation to Israel in exile, Judah in exile, the people of Israel in exile, how that impacted them theologically and how that impacted how we receive the scriptures that we have. And then we can't talk about empire without talking about Constantine. And Constantine, as you may know, is a Roman emperor who converted to Christianity. And so it didn't happen overnight, but I feel kind of like it did, that there was this sudden shift from Christianity being a minority religion, a persecuted religion that did not worship the Roman gods, and so did not have any kind of authority, any kind of power, any kind of political standing, to being the religion of the emperor of Rome and of the state. So how did that change things? And then throughout, I hope not just the fourth session, I know it's a little off the screen there, but I hope we can talk about what that means for us as we trace then what empire throughout the whole history of these scriptures, how that has come to us and what it means for us as people who live in an empire, which, you know, may be new news to some folks that we do live in an empire. And we'll talk about that, what that means, what an empire looks like, what it means for the church, and for the non-church, for a society in which Christianity has so much sway, and this book that we use. So, just throw out some ideas. What is the Bible? The Bible.
A collection of many things.
Oh, I like that.
It's a library.
It's a library.
Collection of many things. My expertise with PowerPoint is matched in shoddiness only by my writing. So if you can't read something, I was a high school teacher, not an elementary school teacher, so this is what you get. You know how elementary school teachers always have
perfect
paper. What was the second? A library? Whoops.
A series of texts that reference themselves over and over.
Ah. That reference themselves. Can you say a little more about that? What you mean by that?
So, we have many books or many stories by different authors. They're collected from oral histories, and they draw on each other, especially when you get into some of the more chronological stuff, like books that are in succession of each other. Mm-hmm. There are references of history to things that happened in the past and things that could happen in the future. Mm-hmm. And so there's a timeline that's built within these texts. And sometimes those references conflict with each other, and sometimes they match up.
Great. Would you like the microphone? And that's awesome. Thank you. You also said something important. There are many writers, many. Some of whom we know, maybe, and some of whom we don't. I think we know fewer of them than we are taught that we know. We'll talk about that later. What else?
A record of how insignificant tribal people grew in their understanding of God.
Big words. Tribal people, very good. this means grew in their understanding of God. Thank you. What else?
Text that the
from the upper tier up here. And then.
A heavily edited compendium.
Compendium, you people are killing me. That's awesome. Edited. And then somebody over here had something?
Text that the patriarchy decided were worthy.
Yeah. This group is on fire. What is the last word, the adjective you use? We're what?
Worthy.
Worthy.
Worthy. All right, just a couple more. There are so many, but yes.
Reflections by God's people on their relationship with God.
I like that too. That's nice. Reflections.
By. How about the rule book? Laws.
People. What was the last? Thank you. Hang on to that for a second. Reflections by God's people.
With God.
And their relationship.
On their relationship with God.
And somebody said rule book. Was there more? You said a little more than that too.
Rule, laws.
Laws.
Guidelines. Instructions. How to. Operating manual.
How to.
I'll take one other side of that. Good news.
Oh, good news.
A book that inspires. Yeah,
when you say good news, tell me more about what you mean by that.
Where is no.
The end. All right, let's hold on to that. We'll see where the good news is.
There's some poetry. There's some pretty sensual stuff.
Let's talk about, that's a good shift. There are, somebody wrote, many writers, reflections by God's people. These take many shapes, don't they? So what genres of writing do we have? Somebody said poetry. Somebody also said
history.
Wisdom.
Instruction.
Propaganda.
Ooh, I love this.
History.
Myth.
Parable.
Letters. Narrative.
Letters. Wow.
Dialogue.
Songs.
It's all in there, right?
Yeah.
You've got all the channels. You've got the History Channel, the Lifetime Network, Oprah Channel,
Discovery Channel.
Discovery Channel. You've got a little Fox News. You've got a little. Got a little CNN.
Sci-fi.
This is really
important.
And a little sci-fi. Yeah, you know, there. As I was looking at things we could look at today, I would love to just do a study on all the things that are really weird. Like if you look right before the story of Noah, there's that whole bit about like giant aliens coming out of nowhere to mate with humanity. Nobody knows what that's about. I've never read a biblical story. I mean, I'm sure they're out there, but in seminary, I don't remember any chapters on that. And it's bizarre. So, there's a little of everything. But this is really important because, I was raised, little Kathy history, I was raised in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church. Who are my Missouri Synod folks? Yeah. Is anybody currently Missouri Synod? Okay, then I can say what I want. Okay. I was raised in a denomination, if you're not Lutheran and you don't know what that means, in Lutheranism, which I don't want to assume everyone here is Lutheran or even Christian or even of any kind of faith tradition. So if I say something that sounds leading that way, it's simply because that's where I come from, but please raise your hand to expand the conversation, okay? But in Lutheranism, there are what they call synods, which are just like denominations within the denomination. And they're sort of divided by progressivism and conservatism, traditionalism and liberalism, and eventually by how they read the Bible. So on the farthest right for you, on the farthest right, there are more than this, but on the farthest right, there are the Wisconsin and Missouri synods, who are very conservative. They read the Bible literally as a history book, as fully divine, inspired by God. And so you can't mess around with interpretation to a certain extent, because it's right there, and that's all there is, the end. And so in those denominations, they don't ordain women because they look at particular texts as supporting that idea. They have what's called close or closed communion, which is a protective thing in theory, that they believe that if you don't understand what communion is, it's not good for you and can actually be harmful. And so only if you're of those people and that understanding can you take communion. You're moving along. So Missouri Synod is sort of like the slightly like conservative, which is what I grew up in, a little house on the prairie sized church in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, home of the groundhog.
Oh, yeah.
And then, you know, they sort of moved to, when I moved to Minneapolis as an adult, to the most moderate of the conservatives. So this is my trajectory. I went to a Missouri Synod college, where our girls' dorm, we would have dorm devotions every night because we were very pious. And all across campus, 10 o'clock dorm devotions. And the dorms were like houses. So a lot like this, actually, where the room, there was a center area and rooms all around. But if the women's dorm decided to host a man's dorm, then you had to either ask their permission to lead the devotions, or they would lead the devotions. So this is how I grew up and what I believed in. Like, yes, this is what God desires, and I am a disobedient, evil person because I want to be a leader in the church. So, long story, many other influences and broader perspectives come into my life. The ELCA is the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and they are kind of way over here on the right, from moderate, which is considered sort of conservative within that denomination, to very progressive. So, all that to say, I forget what I was going with that, but...
The story of your life.
The story of my life, that's right. So, I did not learn in the Missouri Synod that the Bible is a conversation. I learned that it was what we call harmonized, that early scholars looked in the Old Testament for reasons that the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, should be included in the story of Jesus. And so, that pulled out were these particular verses from the prophets that we hear at Advent, right? Oh, Bethlehem of Ephrathah, though you are smallest of the, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. All of these things were kind of pulled out in order to justify having the Old Testament as part of the canon. So I did not grow up knowing all these things that you all know. And, younger person back there, not to be ageist, but good for you. I am so excited that there are people your age and people all over who know these things and talk about the Bible this way, because this is how I love to talk about the Bible, as a conversation. So I wear glasses, as you've seen, and the progression in my life of glasses, how many of you wear corrective lenses? And sometimes you can see them and sometimes you can't. Does anybody have contacts in today? Okay, yep. So I was probably the day I turned 40, just about, I realized I could not read the concordance in my Bible without doing this, the day I turned 40. And somewhere in there, I started using, what they call the cheaters, the reading glasses. Raise your hand if this is your trajectory. And they were all over the house, and it came to pass that the readers were all over the house. Bathroom, I needed some in the car for when I forgot them. And eventually I progressed to bifocals because I thought, I'm done, I need readers all the time. And my first pair of bifocals, I'm farsighted. So I can see when we're driving on the highway, I can tell what road's coming up sooner than anyone. I have very good farsight. At least that's what my eye doctor told me. But I, my first bifocals were just for the readers, but I just decided I'm done messing around. So no correction. Then as time went on, I needed a little correction on the top. And then I switched eye doctors, and I needed a new pair of glasses, and they made them for me, and they didn't work. And it took a few weeks to figure out that my old glasses with the correction on the top lens had a kind of prism in them that my eyes needed, that they didn't detect at first. So these glasses, which are now super scratched up because now with my eyes I need cataract surgery. I'm not going to get new ones till I get that done. Know what I mean? Anybody following this with their own life story? Get ready, young folks. In 20-some years. So that's the story of my glasses, and they're very particular to me, right? They've got the prism, they've got the correction. If anybody who's farsighted but needs reading glasses put them on, they probably wouldn't work, right? How might that apply to reading the Bible? See how I, see what I did there? Let's look at that metaphor. How might that help us when we think about how we read the Bible?
We bring biases.
We bring biases, yeah.
They bring biases.
And the biases are everywhere.
They change over time.
And it changes, yeah.
Metaphor of the interpretive lens.
The interpretive lens, yeah.
If we're reading through someone else's glasses, we might miss things that are specific to their eyesight.
Conversation partners are helpful.
Ooh, I was just going to kind of add that to if we read through, we can't read through someone else's glasses, but we can have conversation partners, including these people. You know, the people that we encounter when we open those pages.
It's interesting, you also, when you're talking about it, I can see the signs ahead better than anyone. It also assumes there is a thing out there to be seen.
Uh-huh.
Which we may see fuzzy or well. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's a limitation of metaphor, I don't know, but the first thing that mm-hmm.
And it may not matter to somebody else what the signs are. You know, my mom, because these glasses, the prescription is old and I need a new prescription, but I'm waiting. When I need these tightened, my mom does this now with her glasses.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody at that stage of life where you have glasses, but to see up close, you move them out of the way? So my mom can do that up close stuff that I have trouble with right now because I need new bifocals. So yeah, it may not matter what's up ahead if my mom is looking at. So that also fits in somehow. We have people who read the Bible, you know, maybe more broadly as the conversation. We have people who study one word in Hebrew for their whole lives, and that gives us an understanding of the story that word appears in or the stories.
Be careful about what doctor you pick for your glasses.
Yes.
Thank you, I will.
Or sometimes we need surgical help and are waiting for the new thing.
Sometimes something has to be removed, right? Which for me was true, in lenses? For me was true in my own upbringing, that there were limitations that I had learned, and I had learned to revere. And it was, for me, as someone who loved school and scholarship and history and the Bible, it was so clarifying to begin to take courses at seminary that helped reset those lenses. That gave me tools like critical analysis and an understanding of who those writers were and all those things. So sometimes things have to be removed in order to put something else in their place, right? Considering this idea of what lenses we wear, that's called social location. How many of you know this term from sociological studies? Social location is an academic term, comes from sociology, and it, as it says here, describes the groups that people belong to because of their place or position in society. This is the culmination of who you are. Your race, your gender, social class, age, ability, religion, sexual orientation, geographic location. This makes social location unique, like your lenses, to each individual. No two people will have the same exact location. Social location is important because it strongly influences our identity and our sense of self and how we see the world. I want to take a minute and just give you a chance to think about your own lenses. So now if you are like me, I sort of cringe when the professor or teacher says, turn to your neighbor, because I don't have my thoughts ready. So if you are a turn to your neighbor type who enjoys that kind of discussion, find another neighbor who wants to talk for a couple of minutes. If you're not a turn to your neighbor type, you can simply say, I'm going to think for myself. And that's just fine.
That's a loaded term.
I didn't mean that in any loaded kind of way. But turn to your neighbor or to your own thoughts and just think about these things, your own social location. Who are you? For example, I would say I'm a cisgender. I identify as the gender I was assigned. Cisgender, white woman, who was born in the USA, who speaks English, who has a particular level of education, whose family was Italian, whose grandparents were immigrants, whose grandparents on the other side were farmers in Minnesota, all those things. And then I want you to just think about how all those things create your sense of values. What is important to you? I know, that's, you know, again, just easy peasy. So just take a couple minutes with your own thoughts or with a neighbor and discuss.
I'm a white.
That three times if you love Bible and Empire. We're not really sure yet, are we? All right, what, just... what are some aspects of your social location? Maybe we'll have like three people describe.
Class.
My social location, I happen to be a white cis hetero male, is invisible to me. I'm not encouraged to see that I have a social location. Mm-hmm. I feel like in our culture, I'm just encouraged to see my perspective as normal, mm-hmm. and everything else is different.
Thank you. Why is that?
I think because our culture is constructed to, I think, preserve power for white cis hetero men, mm-hmm. mostly, and that comes from like making sure everybody buys into our authority. Mm-hmm.
Can everybody hear what's happening down?
Yes.
Okay. A white cis hetero male, and he said he feels like his identity is somewhat invisible in that it is considered the standard or the norm for what it is to be human. You didn't say that part, but to in our society. And so what holds that in place is a particular amount of power. Mm-hmm. All right, what else? How about somebody who does not identify as that? That, as... who does not identify... So we've very broadly taken care of the cis white hetero male. We also have, you know, what your family background is. Are you Christian, not Christian? Are you in this space, are you Lutheran, not Lutheran? What language you speak English as if it's your first language, you might have education, you know, I don't know why I did this. You might have education at a certain level. Okay.
I consider myself Norwegian American, compilation of coming from very rural area, having absorbed some of the elements of urban life. I absolutely hate the word white because I think it's an invitation to become part of an oppressive club, and I don't like that. I even go so far as the first time I did it in our church, I wore the robes for sang the prayers, and I didn't like the idea of a so-called white guy wearing a white robe, I don't know. I didn't like the implications, even though I knew it
very
was
very thoughtful, all. Yeah.
Yeah, so I haven't done it since. And now I have to, part of my location is senior.
Okay, yep. Mm-hmm. Who are we talking about that with the senior? I think it was with Stacy and some other folks at our table, identifying the reality that you get to a certain age where you have to start thinking about what food you put in your body at what time of day, and thinking about whether you really want to get up and walk back to the cabin or not. And I've seen you use this for fun or for a cane or.
No, it's partly pride. It's from the Missouri River in North Dakota.
Oh, nice.
And
nice.
So I started using it because I was proud that I was given by my sister's husband, Reggie, who made it out of willow, willow from the Missouri River there in North Dakota. But I found that, like, if I travel, I'm treated differently.
Oh, okay.
May I help you? You know, like,
yeah.
So, but I don't know. It's nice to have the stability of three legs as opposed to two. Mm-hmm.
And that, I was thinking of that too for myself. Some of you have seen I ride around on the cart sometimes.
And I've had some falls. Okay.
Oh, okay. So,
actually,
safety
issues. I had a fall one day. I was running out of our church down this hill in Ballard.
Oh.
And I saw this bushes, and I thought I could just jump over, and it turned out there was barbed wire in the bushes. And it was almost like a trap, and I ended up face down on the sidewalk.
Oh my gosh.
So that was horrible.
I'm glad you're here with us today.
So now I use the cane with pride.
Awesome.
He also uses it to threaten us Swedes.
Ooh, we got a little social location going on right there, right?
And he's my number one Swede.
There you go. So you have some, there's something about age there. There's something about, you said you grew up in a rural context.
Yes.
Which is different than growing up in the city, right? There's something about ability there. Yes.
When I first... But the first city I came to, you mentioned Minneapolis, the first city I came to, I went to Concordia and Moria, and I had a friend from St. Paul. In fact, his dad taught at the University of Minnesota on the St. Paul campus there. And when I came for a summer job, I got off the bus, and I called my friend Eric, and Eric says, well, take the number so-and-so and the number so-and-so. I thought, that's so cold. Like out in rural North Dakota, we'd never have somebody, you know, if somebody came to visit, we would go get them, you know?
A different culture.
So when I got on the bus, I really remember feeling like I'm gonna be killed because that's what they do in cities, you know?
Okay.
There's a lot of violence.
Assumptions about other...
Yeah.
Cultures, other tribes, other places. Thank you.
The opposite happened. I had a map, and there was a gentleman sitting next to me on this bus, and he said, well, where are you going? So I didn't know. He helped me, you know, kind of research.
He did not kill you. You found one of the good ones, though.
Yeah, that came later.
Minnesota, nice.
Let's hear from somebody who identifies differently than what we've heard already. I'm thinking of someone maybe who identifies as a woman. And thank you. I mean, thank you to the two guys. Let's hear. Yep.
I was feeling the mids this morning. I'm from the Midwest. I'm middle-aged, middle-class, straight, cishet woman from Chicago. but suburban princess at the same time.
If you're not hearing all that straight, Midwest, filling the mids, Midwest, middle age, from Chicago, but suburban middle, princess.
Yes, middle class. Yeah, so I think the mids were sitting with me this morning.
Okay, great. How about one more person? How about from the upper tier? Those closest to heaven.
There's someone down here, Gavin.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I was a woman. A lot of stuff has already been said, but I recently kind of got a jerk to my social location. I always thought of myself as a northerner.
Ah,
and so okay. I am, but I have heritage in the eastern shore of Maryland, and I learned that some ancestors were slaveholders in fact.
Okay.
So I had to say, you know, I always sort of said, oh, well, at least that's not in my northern family, but there it was.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Oh, how did you, so she said, she, is that your pronoun?
It is.
Okay. She said, grew up in the north of the Mason-Dixon, right? And considered herself a northerner, but then through some family history stuff, found out she had relatives in Maryland who had been slaveholders. So how did you integrate that into your sense of self?
Well, I didn't like it very much, but I sort of said, well, you know, I don't know if I've integrated, but it's sort of like, oh, there it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's there. It's part of me, right?
Yeah.
Which also brings up our social location. We are not born without context, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm stealing that from my teacher, Eleazar Fernandez at United Seminary, who wrote a wonderful book called Reimagining the Human. And he talks about how we are each born into a context from even the moment you're conceived. You're conceived by people with a particular DNA that will mark your body with, he talks about marked bodies, bodies that are marked by skin tone, by size, by disability. You pop out, it's that easy, right? I've never had a kid, but I hear that sometimes. You pop out, and you're, what's the first thing? In the olden days especially, but what's the first thing people want to know when they know you're
girl? It's
boy.
What the gender is, and it's along the binary, right? Boy or girl. And I've occasionally thought this would be horrible for the woman giving birth, but I've occasionally thought, what if that baby could just stop when the head and shoulders come out. And we could just celebrate that is a human being before we start assigning things.
Right.
But we do, right? That's our human nature to categorize. And
yeah.
So you bringing up the ancestors is important too. I mean, in my family, at Christmas time, we grew up with the Italian side, so we have ravioli and squid at Christmas. People, I've heard of this thing called lefse, that people in my adopted home of Minnesota have, you know, all of that, the ancestors come with us, right? Well, thank you for sharing, and I know you all have your stories of who you are and how you got to be that person. Let's look at, oopsies, we have just a little bit more time here, we have like 13 minutes. And if I get to 10 o'clock, please just tell me it's 10 o'clock, because technology, phones, things, I forget. Let's talk about, for those of us who brought us this collection of stories and poetry and everything that you've already identified that we call the Bible, the social location of the ancient Near East. The ancient Near East is what some scholars decided this area of land was called, this area right here and all of this. Oh, you can't see. I'm using my arrow, so I'm reminding myself. It's not Near East to them. It's just where they live, right? But in the central, this is also part of empire. In the centralizing of ourselves, we identify people in relation to us, right? So the Far East, the Near East, the Middle East, you know, the South. Australia likes to think of themselves as the center, so, you know, they see us differently. So in the ancient Near East, A-N-E, as pretentious scholars like me call it, not really pretentious, I know many of us use that. The ancient Near East, and I'm talking like 3000 BC-ish, we're just going to whip through some history here. Mesopotamia, this area, those of you that did not have John Katanning for 8th grade social studies, Mesopotamia means...
Between the rivers.
Between the rivers, right. So, and do you remember what the rivers are?
Tigris and Euphrates.
Well done. Mr. Katana is smiling from heaven on you. Between the rivers. This is what's called the Fertile Crescent. This area right here. And it's where the water was. So when you have the early, and then there's Egypt where the water also was, the Nile Delta and all that, and the river. And so this is where the earliest civilizations grew up, the places where the first cities started appearing, and where as those cities started to grow and become more populated and more engaged with each other, either through trade or war, things like writing and government began to develop. For the people that we know of as eventually the Jews, the Israelites, the people from Judah, they began as nomadic tribes, tribes that went between these places, traded. I tend to think, because of my upbringing, I tend to think they just were there. They were always together, moving as a unit. But this is not the case. Skipping ahead to, and preliterate. So their language was trade. Their language wasn't writing. They didn't have need for receipts, things like that. History and myth and story were passed down verbally. And there were collective characteristics with the people around them. So though your god may have been the god of this nation or this nation, you may have all believed that sacrifice was a way to appease the gods. Or certain rituals may have been transferred from people to people. So we talk about how Israel came into the land, meaning sort of settled and started to become more agrarian in this area, Canaan, around 1200 BCE is what we say, before the Common Era, which again sort of centralizes us as the Common Era CE. But we say BCE, we used to say BC and AD, but we've sort of changed that for expansive purposes. So around 1200 BCE, that's when scholars feel that the people who became Israel, they say, emerged into the land. Around 1000, David, who we think of, who I have always thought of kind of as a King Arthur type, but really was more of like a Braveheart type, a clan king. David united all the clans of the tribe. And that was sort of considered kind of a golden era. I'm not sure for everyone, but that's how it's remembered by at least those who get to tell the story. So, you know, David was the king. And then who was king after David?
Solomon.
And Solomon was a little less of a good king and began making alliances with other... And I mean, there's so much more going on, but this is what's happening in general. Began making foreign alliances. He had all those foreign wives. And it's really interesting to me that Solomon is portrayed as so wise. I was just reading the books of Kings again, you know, as one does at camp, at Holden. And I'm just amazed by how obvious it is who's telling the story. That we received the book of Kings probably from, and we'll get into this a little more tomorrow, but the elites of Israel, who were from the southern kingdom, where Solomon reigned. And so Solomon is like, oh, so wise, and his wisdom was known, and people came from miles around. The Queen of Sheba tried to stump him, and her spirit was down when she left because she could not, you know, he was so smart. And yet. So Solomon's big mistake, as the Dixie Chicks would sing, there's your trouble. As you may recall from Sunday school, David
Chicks,
wanted...
No Dixie in that chick.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. The yes, Chicks. Now, thank you so much. Chicks. I appreciate that. The Chicks. Solomon, David wanted to build a temple, and the story, the narrative tells us, I keep pointing to the Bible, the narrative tells us that God said, no, I don't live in a place. Well, Solomon, it says, according to those who told the story and wrote it down later, says, was given permission, and his big mistake, two things, and they received just so little attention, like one line, is that he conscripted labor from the northern kingdom. It wasn't the northern kingdom yet, from the north. So, down, and if you want to look in your Bibles, I meant to put up another map of just the kingdoms, and I didn't get it in there. But down here in the southern part, that's where Solomon, and that's where where the kings lived. And that's where he built the temple in Jerusalem. And he conscripted labor, forced labor and taxes from the outsiders. In Minnesota, we say outstate. Anything that's not us in the Twin Cities is outstate. And he taxed them. So there's this, what's the contradiction there? If you have to come to Jerusalem to work, you're not at home working to raise money to pay the taxes for the work that you're doing. People were not happy. And so that created a rift, and then eventually Rehoboam, who was even worse, this is all just fascinating stuff. Rehoboam was even worse, and that the kingdom split. So you have, and the way the Book of Kings described it is that God was mad too, but God allowed one tribe, Judah, one group to stay in the south to honor King David. But then all the other tribes were up north. So this divided kingdom, all of this just led to more and more vulnerability. And in 722, these are two dates that they drill into in Bible studies. In 722, the northern kingdom was taken over by the Assyrians, which were, if I had my stick like last night, were up there in the red part. And the Assyrians didn't take anyone away. They just kind of took over and moved in. And so this is why the Samaritans became reviled, because the capital of the northern kingdom was Samaria, and historically the Jews, who are not yet called Jews, the people of Israel there intermarried. And that is why there is just this long, and many other reasons, but particularly that and the adoption of other gods and all that, is why there was such resentment from the southern kingdom and why that lasted through Jesus' day. In the southern kingdom, they lasted a couple hundred years longer, and in 586, they were taken over by Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. He is not the fun-loving, dopey cucumber of VeggieTales. But he was a strategist, and everybody wanted to conquer everything, and he not only conquered Israel, but Judah, southern kingdom, but destroyed the temple. And part of the problem with Solomon was, another part of the problem, was that he centralized worship at the temple. This is where God lives. And this is where God is. Which is completely different from the narrative of Moses, where is God? Everywhere. God is everywhere the people are, in the tabernacle. Yes?
So, God leads Moses and the now freed Israelites to a promised land.
Mm-hmm.
Would that not also be centralizing? Or is it different to centralize worship versus lead to a promised land?
That's a good question. I guess that, before the time of the kings, there were judges and prophets, and they were the leaders religiously and politically. And so I guess I don't know, but I would think that before the temple was built, there were, well, even after the temple was built, there was worship everywhere. But the temple, you had to make a pilgrimage every year. The temple was where you were a true believer and a true child of Israel and God if you came to the temple and the closer you lived to the temple. So, you know, sort of like there are congregations everywhere, but if you go to Chicago, then you're visiting Church Y. Not really like that, but that's the example I can think of. Does that make sense? I actually don't know the full answer to that. I'll try to find something out about that. That's a good question.
Yes. I think it's a great question, too. I haven't thought about it. It seems to me relative to your topic.
Pardon me?
It seems to me relative to your topic that the conjunction of land and people is what begins to form empire, as opposed to other sorts of folks who relate to the land differently. So I would say it's the same thing.
Well, and the control of resources, you know, and the centralization of supposed leadership. If you decide you're going to have a king, that's only one person, and they have to live somewhere. Mm-hmm. And where that king lives, that becomes the place of power, the epicenter, the nexus. What's the right word?
Nexus.
One of them. The nexus of power?
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's also true that, well, they've combined church and state, in a sense. They probably were already combined, but I mean, by having that in Jerusalem, this is where God lives. God was mobile before. Mm-hmm. God becomes a God of place after once the kings have established religion.
And so, when the temple is destroyed by cucumber Nebuchadnezzar, what happens to God? That's the question. And this is the trauma of the exile.
Yeah.
That the place where God touches earth and chooses, it says in Kings several times, the God is supposed to have said, I have chosen this place.
Yeah.
What happens when that place is destroyed? And we're going to stop there because I think it's 10, time for coffee. And tomorrow, Babylonian exile. Thank you very much. If you would put your Bibles back on the rack, and then grab them again tomorrow, take a look.